It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. First, growing up in the Midwest, I remember learning the history of the region something like this. There were Native Americans here before European settlers came, but then American and European immigrants came in the 1800s and settled a mostly empty, unpopulated wilderness. If you look at maps of the history of the region, you can see Wisconsin as a French possession, then a British territory, then part of the newly created United States, even though the indigenous population was larger than the European population until well into the 1800s. Our next guest says there's a huge story hidden by commonly held views of history, of efforts to expand the boundaries of American statehood by taking land from Native Americans, and of resistance to those efforts by the indigenous people of Wisconsin and the wider Midwest. In his new book, he tells the story of treaties made and violated, land stolen and sold, and the Native leaders, U.S. government officials, and others in the middle of the story. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What questions do you have about indigenous tribes and the colonization of Wisconsin? What do you remember learning about that period in history? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. Michael Witkin is a professor in the Department of History and the Center for the Study of Ethnicity and Race at Columbia University. He's a citizen of the Red Cliff Band of Lake Superior Ojibwe. His latest book is called Seeing Red, Indigenous Land, American Expansion, and the Political Economy of Plunder in North America. It was named a Pulitzer Prize finalist this year. Michael, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
Can you talk about this effort that's at the heart, I think, of your book, correcting this gap that I certainly grew up with in my understanding of the history of our region?
Yeah, I think the way you phrased it here at the beginning, that thinking about the history of Wisconsin, or at least the non-native history, as a colonial history, as a history of this colonization of Wisconsin, I think that's kind of new to most people. And I think that's one of the things that I wanted to recover, that this wasn't a state or a continent that was sort of empty and settled by pioneers who tamed a wilderness, but rather it was an indigenous continent, and its settlement by non-native people was an act of colonization.
The idea from even before the United States became a country that was at the heart of this seems to be, okay, we define use of land in this way. A person holds title to this piece of land and improves it. And Native Americans aren't doing that, not in the way we'd expect. That, therefore, that gives us, the English, and then the Americans, the right to take that land. That seems to be at the heart of so much of westward expansion, including here in what was the Northwest Territory.
Absolutely. I mean, so this is the sort of idea of discovery, or sometimes called the doctrine of discovery. And this is the idea that when Europeans arrive in the Americas, and in North America in particular, that they found a new world, and that new world was, for all intents and purposes, uninhabited because it didn't have sort of recognizable forms of property or private property like you would have in Western Europe. And with that as a sort of framework, the original colonial project allowed monarchs from Europe to say, I've discovered this land, it's unsettled, and therefore I can claim it by right of discovery. The right of discovery becomes a way in which they grant the crown charters to colonies in the Eastern Seaboard. There's the Seven Years' War where the two competing empires, France and Great Britain, compete with one another. France loses. They cede their claims to North America to the British. And following the Revolution, at the settlement of that war, the British Empire cedes huge swaths of North America to the United States, all through this idea about a right of discovery, that they were essentially passing land that had been claimed because it was unsettled by kings, claimed as a possession, incorporated into empire, and then transferred to the Republic. And so the Republic basically takes up that same ideological project, the idea that the territory in the west of the Appalachian Mountains that had been granted to it by the Treaty of Paris that ends the Revolution is unsettled land. And the U.S. sets out to kind of settle that. And the story of Wisconsin is totally wrapped up in that process, the settlement where the United States has to come to grips with the fact that the land is not empty, that it's occupied by Native people, and that settling isn't just a matter of moving settlers onto a forest and changing it, but rather engaging with Native people and then actively sort of working to colonize them and their land.
We operated under this Northwest Ordinance here in the Northwest Territory that included Wisconsin. Can you talk about what that was and how it set the stage for how that land would be taken and then distributed?
Sure. So the Northwest Ordinance is the way by which the United States figures out what to do with it. When we come out of the Revolution, all this land really from the Appalachian Mountains out to the Mississippi, the United States regards as part of its public domain. That is, it's the land that I mentioned have been transferred by the Great Britain to the United States. It's not settled by Americans. Therefore, they consider it public land that's controlled by the federal government. And they decide the way to settle that orderly with the Northwest Ordinance, which is a land law. And the ordinance is a way that you can both organize territory and that will eventually become a state, and then also sell the land within that territory. And the way the Northwest Ordinance works is that when you get 5,000 free white men, that's enough to organize a space as a territory, so the territory of Michigan or the territory of Indiana. Once the territory is organized, the progression goes from 5,000 free white men to 60,000 free white settlers. When you've reached the 60,000 population mark, the territory can petition the federal government to enter the union as a state with its own constitution, and then it enters the union as a state with all the rights and privileges that other states. And so that's the model that's used in order to create territories, turn the Northwest Territory into specific territories, the states that are now Ohio, Indiana, Illinois, Michigan, Wisconsin, and parts of Minnesota were all part of the original Northwest Territory. And for the most part, in the southern tier of the Northwest Territories, Indiana, Ohio, Illinois, they fill up really fast. And they reach the requisite population of 60,000 persons to become states and enter the Union all within the early 1800s. Ohio is a state in 1803. Illinois and Indiana, I think, are 1808 and 1818, respectively. They become states in the Union. And it's in part because those territories are all connected to the Ohio River, to the Mississippi. And the Mississippi connects that territory to the sort of larger market economy of the U.S., New Orleans, St. Louis. And so it makes sense if you want to be a farmer in Ohio or in Illinois, you can get your product to a market than a U.S. market. But above the Ohio River, what would now be, say, Michigan and Ohio territory, it makes a lot less sense to settle. And so those territories actually remain territories for a long time. Michigan Territory, which is formed in 1805, actually stays a territory, doesn't get the 60,000 population threshold until 1837. And Wisconsin isn't even organized as a territory until 1837. Before that time, it's part of Michigan. And as late as 1820, the Michigan Territory, which would have been Michigan now, plus Wisconsin, plus Minnesota, had less than 20,000 non-native settlers. And that's, you know, going into 1820. So that's really late. It's not till the Erie Canal is completed and opens in 1826 that it begins to make sense to start moving into these more northern parts of the Northwest Territory, because only then can you start getting things like agricultural products or timber out to a market in the U.S.
Talking to Michael Witkin about his book, Seeing Red, Indigenous Land, American Expansion, and the Political Economy of Plunder in North America. You can join in if you have questions at 800-642-1234. Michael, a huge part of the story you tell is of how natives in Wisconsin and beyond reacted to this drive to populate the states with settlers from out east. What were some of the key points in the story you researched?
There's several key points. There's an important treaty in 1837 that cedes a huge swath of Wisconsin, now is Wisconsin, I think something around the nature of 11 million acres. And it's a treaty that the indigenous peoples tell American officials they don't want to cede. And there's not a lot of population pressure in 1837 for that northern Wisconsin territory. But the U.S. basically tells the native people that they have to cede it or it'll be taken from them. And so they do. And they are compensated something about, I think, in the nature of around 13 cents per acre, which the U.S. can then turn around and sell through the Northwest Ordinance for $1 an acre. So making an enormous amount of profit. And then that property often enters into circulation in private becomes private property of individuals who sit on it and don't necessarily develop it right away, and maybe sit on it for 10 or 15 years where it can still sell for, say, $80 an acre. So you have this sort of massive transfer of land and wealth from native people to the federal government, and then the transfer of that federal government, that land as a public domain to the individual settlers in the United States, basically at a subsidized way of settling the settlement, because you can sell that land at a way below market rate because the government has a monopoly when they acquire it from native people. So it's a process where you're sort of facilitating the colonization by creating a sort of a monopoly on land sales and then making that land available in a really affordable manner to most people in order to encourage immigration.
And that's at the heart of the idea of plunder you introduce, actually, even in the subtitle of your book. Can you talk about the scope of financial benefit to the United States, individuals, and to the federal government of that sort of forced appropriation of land and then distribution of it?
This was one of the things that really was a surprise for me. And if you think about the United States and the histories we all get in elementary school and junior high school and high school, these standard kind of survey histories, when you get to the early Republic, where you tend to find Indians in that history in a standard survey is with the Trail of Tears, the really tragic removal of Native peoples from what would then be the Southeast. You can think places like Georgia, North Carolina, the Alabama, Mississippi, the Trail of Tears. That's pretty common. And that makes sense with the story. There's a hunger for land. Indians are facing pressure. They're removed. You don't have that in the Northwest Territories. I mean, to some extent, Ohio, Illinois, Indiana, as I said, fill up really quick. But the land in territories like Michigan and Wisconsin, there's just less demand for it. And because there's less demand for it, the federal government sort of needs to entice people to move in. And what ends up happening is rather than having a pressure to remove Indians, people in states like Michigan and Wisconsin quickly discover that having Indians in place, this sort of colonized subject, is way more lucrative than kicking them off and taking over their land. And I say it's more lucrative because the treaty process where federal representatives of the federal government come in, negotiate with tribal members, often through people that are traders or Indian agents. And most of the traders and Indian agents are intermarried with the tribe, so they have indigenous wives and children. And they negotiate these treaties to cede land in exchange for a payment of money. Well, I mentioned that before with the 1837 treaty. So you get a $20,000 cash payment for 10 years for the sale of this 13 million acres. But when that payment is made, and the federal officials would show up with specie, with actual currency, which is often rare in early 19th century America, that payout usually went something in the neighborhood of 90% or more to traders or merchants who would claim that Native peoples owed them debt from the fur trade, and debt that hadn't been repaid. And so each of these payments that were coming in to compensate Native people for the sale of land by a forced treaty, the money for that would mostly not end up in Native hands. It would mostly end up in the hands of merchants, traders, agents, people who were engaged in this fur trade. They would take that money and invest in their business, develop it in that way. The same merchants who were claiming that that money is debt would also be hired out by the government. Part of the payment was a cash payment in compensation for the land cession, but part of it was, say, $10,000 in provisions and goods. The federal government would buy those from the same merchants who were claiming it as debt. So they're making money by claiming the cash as debt. They're making money by covering the provisions that are also part of the annual payment for land sales by providing that to the federal government. So basically, you've got the sort of the leaders of the Wisconsin Territory, the Michigan Territory, often people who are connected with the fur trade, that history, helping it transition out of the fur trade and out of the Indian era by facilitating these land transfers, which bring tons of cash into the state or territory, cash that they then themselves can claim. So there's a lot of money to be made in not removing the Indians like you do in, say, Georgia or Alabama, but keeping them in place and negotiating treaty after treaty, which brings cash in, which you can then claim. So that cash becomes a way in which people basically develop the infrastructure of their businesses and the state economy. And it's a way of basically not just taking land, but really taking the wealth and land together, kind of plundering the resources of the indigenous population in order to sort of economically develop the state and territory.
Talking to Columbia University History Professor Michael Witkin about the book Seeing Red, Indigenous Land, American Expansion, and the Political Economy of Plunder in North America. In his work, he focuses a lot on Wisconsin and the surrounding region. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you have a question for our guest about his research and Native history in Wisconsin, the history of U.S. settlement in the region? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. We'll pick up the conversation coming up on Central Time. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We're talking to Michael Witkin about his book, Seeing Red, Indigenous Land, American Expansion, and the Political Economy of Plunder in North America. Let's go to our callers at 800-642-1234. Jeff is with us in Superior. Jeff, hi. Jeff, are you there?
Yeah, I'm here. Can you hear me, Jeff? Now?
Yep, go for it.
Well, this is living history, and it's very exciting to share with you that last year in 2022, we transferred land from the city of Superior, the Diocese of Superior, and the Douglas County back to the Fond du Lac tribe. First time they've owned land in Wisconsin, I think, since the Treaty of 1857. So under the right leadership, you can right some wrongs from the past, and it's an exciting time to remember that, 170 years later or something.
Jeff, thanks for the call. Michael, you are definitely thinking about this history you write about in the present day. What kind of things are you watching for with current land issues related to the descendants of the people you write about?
Well, that's a really interesting story, and I'm interested in those sort of land back sort of movements. A lot of the land in northern Wisconsin and northern Michigan, the UP, is ceded when there really isn't demand for it. There's maybe some demand for mining, some demand for timbering, but a lot of that land has then passed into sometimes public trust for counties or universities or other things. Sometimes it's passed into it was privately owned, but now it's owned. It's public land, and that restoring that kind of land, that's really fascinating to hear that kind of history. I've been interested in that. I think it's also quite interesting that a lot of the land that comes out of these treaties that I mentioned makes its way into the financial instruments that are used to create the land grant colleges in the United States, the Morrill Act, which creates which mandated the creation of a land grant university in all the states in the Union, which is a university that focuses on agricultural training. Those universities are all funded through the Morrill Act, which used basically land that had been ceded by the tribes in the United States that have been turned into financial instruments like a bond and then sold or given back to the states. And the states then cashed those land scripts in order to fund the endowments for the land grant universities. Huge amounts of the territory that had been ceded in the 1837 treaty makes its way into the public domain that's then used for funding land grant universities. So, I mean, it's part of the public infrastructure of the United States comes from this transfer of land. And I think reckoning with that and coming to grips with it and finding things like in Superior where you can maybe give the land back if it's possible is a really interesting sort of recognition of this colonial history and sort of undoing some of the legacies of it.
Thanks for that call, Jeff. Michael, I don't want to miss something in your book. It isn't all big picture stuff. You share real people and their stories. One amazing story was leaders from the St. Croix Band of Ojibwe journeying against the advice of federal officials to negotiate directly with President Millard Fillmore in 1852 with some consequences. Can you briefly share that story?
Yeah, that's right. Actually, it was one of my distant relatives was on that trip, and it was a moment where when the treaties had been signed in Wisconsin, one of the provisions that leaders were making was that we won't be removed. And they were saying this is the era of removal. And they said, well, sign the treaties if you're going to force us, but we want to remain on our land. And so that treaty had been made in 1854. The U.S. government was making plans to go back and remove tribes from northern Wisconsin. And they got wind of it. Some leaders did, as you mentioned, and they sort of snuck off the reservation, made their way to Washington, D.C., and were able to secure an audience with the president and get his commitment to not remove them, to let them stay on their homelands. And so it's a kind of an amazing example of Ojibwe people fighting to remain in their homeland, taking whatever they could in order to preserve that homeland, that territory, that connection to that landscape. And in this case, the journey was kind of amazing. They got stopped in Detroit. The Indian Nation let them go on. They ran out of money in New York. They actually staged a dinner in a New York hotel where they invited people to come in and dine with the Ojibwe chiefs from Lake Superior to fund the rest of the trip to make it to D.C. So it was quite an amazing escapade in the 19th century where Indians were sort of popular cultural figures, but they're also sort of real people fighting to maintain their homeland. And that's part of the story of why Native people in Wisconsin don't get removed. They fought and resisted to stay in their homeland. And I would put a final note, they brought with them letters from a lot of the towns in Wisconsin on the Superior shoreline who were telling federal government they wanted, in fact, Indians to stay because they also recognized this political economy of plunder that I was mentioning. And they said, Indians are good neighbors, and so we don't want them removed. So they traveled with letters from non-Native peoples in Wisconsin who were also asking, along with the Ojibwe, to not let them be removed to Indian territory. Pretty amazing story.
Time for one more caller. Nancy is with us in Winneconne. Nancy, hi.
Hi. Thank you. I was in Kalamazoo, Michigan, a few months ago, and there are some historical markers around the city, and they indicated that they, I believe they were Potawatomi who lived in that area, and they were forced to go west. I don't remember exactly where they had to go, but I recall that they had to leave.
Nancy, thanks for the call. And Michael, do you want to see wider efforts to share the history that you recount in your book, whether it's that public sign or other venues?
Absolutely. I think people don't realize the extent to which the history, particularly the Midwest, is an indigenous history. And American history is really intertwined with indigenous history in a way that can't be separated. So thinking about that is really important. I think thinking about the way that our public lands get created or public universities get created off this kind of colonial relationship is super important. Helping people realize that there's a connection with Native people have to land that still exists today, that's historic, that precedes America, is really important when people see tribes exercising treaty rights, those sorts of things. So I'm all for getting this sort of message, this history out.
Michael, we'll leave it there. Thanks again for joining us today.
Thank you for having me. I really appreciate the opportunity.
That's Michael Witkin, professor in the Department of History and the Center for Study of Ethnicity and Race at Columbia University. He's a citizen of the Red Cliff Band of Lake Superior Ojibwe. He was with us today to share his latest book. It's called Seeing Red, Indigenous Land, American Expansion, and the Political Economy of Plunder in North America. That was named a Pulitzer Prize finalist this year. I'm Rob Ferret. Stick around. There's more to come on Central Time. Remember, you can follow these conversations all the time, anytime. Stream live at WPR.org or check out our extremely extensive archives there. You can also download the Wisconsin Public Radio app. You're listening to the Ideas Network. Listening to Central Time, I'm Rob Ferret. Now, think of the last time you put some ice in a beverage. Probably pretty recently, given our summer heat. For me, this morning in my coffee, last night in a mocktail. Did you stop to think about how convenient it is that you have ice on demand? It's probably always been that easy to cool off a drink, right? Well, not so fast. There's a centuries-old story about how we came to use frozen water as a commodity in the U.S. and around the world. It even involves some good old-fashioned hardball business practices right here in Wisconsin. You can join in at 800-642-1234. If you ever had to go without ice or without refrigeration, how did that affect you and your food and beverage choices? How do you use ice in your day-to-day life? Big fan of skating rinks, say? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. Amy Brady is executive director of Orion Magazine, a contributing editor for Scientific American and co-editor of The World as We Knew It, Dispatches from a Changing Climate. Her new book is called Ice, From Mixed Drinks to Skating Rinks, A Cool History of a Hot Commodity. Amy, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thanks so much for having me.
What motivated you to stop taking ice for granted and tackle it in this book?
A few years ago, there was a heat wave that gripped the planet, and I was visiting family back in my home state of Kansas. The heat wave knocked out the power into our to their house, and so we piled into their car and went to a nearby gas station that was operating on a generator. Inside, there was air conditioning, there was a soda machine, and I filled a cup with ice to try to cool down. And as I was watching that ice fall into my cup, it just occurred to me that I hadn't thought twice about whether ice would be available. I just knew if I went to that gas station, I'd find it. Or if I went the other direction to the nearby grocery store, I could have bought a bag of ice. And I wondered, why is that the case? Why is ice available everywhere? Because it really isn't in other places around the world. Well, when I got home and the electricity came back on, I tried to do some research to find an answer to that question, and I couldn't find a satisfying answer. So I decided to look more in depth, and ultimately, a fascinating history of how ice on demand came to be started to reveal itself, and that was the premise for this book.
Now, back in the day, you could have ice if you were rich and lived in a place that had frozen ponds or rivers nearby. You dig into the story of the first ice entrepreneur in the United States who ends up shipping ice to the Caribbean. Can you share a little bit of his story and how he made this an actual business?
Yeah, the first person to make ice into a business. He was the person who launched the American ice trade. His name was Frederick Tudor. He was a wealthy Bostonian. Some might have called him a madman. People did call him a madman in his day. And as a late teen, and then a man in his early 20s, he landed on this idea to carve large blocks of ice out of his family's lake on their estate in Massachusetts and ship it to people who lived in warm climates around the world. And he just knew that once people got a taste of cold, they would never look back, and he would make millions of dollars. And it took years and years of trial and error, but that eventually was the case.
And it wasn't a gimme. The thing he had to do, the marketing technique he stumbled on, was to actually give ice free to bartenders, right? And say, hey, you can make cold rum drinks instead of room temperature rum drinks. How did that catch on?
That's exactly right. So one of the first places that he tried to sell ice to were people living in Cuba. And what he knew after years of failure there, he just couldn't get people to buy his ice, was that nobody in Havana trusted him, but they all trusted their local baristas. Cafe culture was dominant in Cuba. So he went to the local cafes and he said to the owners, "Look, I'm going to give you some ice for free. And that way you can use it to make these most delicious drinks. And then you can sell it to your customers at the same price as you would sell lukewarm drinks. And let's just see which one they like the best." Well, just as in today, back then, you really can't argue with a cold drink on the rocks. And people clamored for it, and he ended up making a killing.
Talking to Amy Brady about her new book, Ice, From Mixed Drinks to Skating Rinks, A Cool History of a Hot Commodity. You can join in with your questions, your thoughts on ice, its accessibility, its history. Join in at 800-642-1234. Let's bring on a caller. Chris is with us in Adams. Chris, hi.
Hi. I was living in Lowell, and the bartender said that there was a tunnel underneath his bar, and we thought about what it could possibly be. Then I went and did a little bit of investigation. It was a tunnel from the river up through the bar to the brewery at the top of the hill, and they would take horses and cut big blocks of ice out of the river and take them up through the tunnel all the way from the brewery down to the river, and they put hay on top of them, and then they put the beer in there, and it lasted all summer.
Chris, thank you so much for sharing that story. Now, Amy, that wasn't the only place that was happening in Wisconsin. You write of an ice war in Milwaukee, where they were supplying ice to brewers making cold German lagers there. What ended up happening?
This is one of my favorite stories that came out of my research. So, in the early 20th century, around 1900, 1901, there was a company harvesting ice out of the Milwaukee River that went by, ironically, as the Wisconsin Lakes Ice and Cartage Company. And Wisconsin Lakes was the only ice company in the region for years and years and years. But then that changed when another company came in called the Pike and North Lake Company that started harvesting ice out of Lake Michigan. Well, this was at the peak of the Industrial Revolution when rivers were really, really dirty. And so the Pike Company launched this smear campaign against Wisconsin Lakes that was harvesting out of the Milwaukee River, saying that their ice was really dirty. Well, Wisconsin Lakes didn't take kindly to that. So they looked at Pike Company's infrastructure to see, is there any way that we can get back at them? And sure enough, what they realized was that the Pike Company had bought land to build their ice houses close to the railroads, the same type of railroads that was probably delivering ice to that bar that your caller just talked about. But what they had failed to do was to buy the land between the ice houses and the railroads. So Wisconsin Lakes ended up buying that intermediate land area and then waited until Pike Company had harvested a bunch of ice and was ready to bring it to the railroads for delivery. And when they did that, Wisconsin Lakes slapped them with a trespassing order, and all of their ice went to waste. Well, the Pike Company decided this was war. And so what they did in retaliation was really one of the best acts of revenge I think I've ever read. What they did is that they waited until that Wisconsin Lakes was harvesting for their next big delivery. Now, at the time, river tourism was pretty popular. And so what Pike Company did is that they bought a steamship and sold tickets to tourists. But what separated their steamship from all the other touristy steamships is that they outfitted theirs with an icebreaker. And so right when Wisconsin Lakes was getting ready to harvest their ice, they filled the ship, they hired a band to play a jazzy tune, and as the band played, they brought their steamship right through the ice that Wisconsin Lakes was harvesting, sending the ice harvesters running and breaking that valuable ice into millions of splinters. It was really like Titanic in reverse.
Pretty cold-hearted. Now, Amy, before we enter the industrial ice era, I want to check out a historical character I didn't know existed. Now, we get to a point where people have ice boxes in their house. They get ice deliveries, right into their door. And there's this iconic figure of the sexy Iceman. Tell us about him.
So one of the most fascinating things I uncovered in my research was that by the time we get to the end of the 19th century, early 20th century, when ice delivery to people's homes was reaching its peak, we also find all of these popular songs with lyrics about housewives falling in love with the Iceman. I also found these vintage Valentine's Day cards with puns about the sexy Iceman. And I was wondering, why is this? Why was this nation fascinated with Icemen? Because they weren't the only delivery men of the era. There were milkmen, there were mailmen. But what I realized is that of all the delivery people of the era, the Iceman was the only one to come inside the house to bring their product to the kitchen. And they would often come into the house when the husband was away at work. And this was a time when there was a lot of anxiety around women being alone with men who weren't their husbands. And so this created a nationwide fascination and an anxiety around the Iceman. One of my favorite cultural finds was this song that was written in the 1930s that was later popularized by Ray Charles that went something like, I'm moving to the outskirts of town and I'm buying my woman a Frigidaire so we can get rid of that Iceman.
We're talking to Amy Brady, executive director of Orion Magazine. Her new book is called Ice, From Mixed Drinks to Skating Rinks, A Cool History of a Hot Commodity. You could join in at 800-642-1234. Do you have questions about ice, how we used to get it, what led to the era of freezers in every home? Do you rely on ice for entertainment? Maybe that skating rink, curling, for example? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. We'll pick up the conversation coming up on Central Time. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We continue our talk with Orion Magazine executive editor Amy Brady. We're talking about her new book. It's called Ice, From Mixed Drinks to Skating Rinks, A Cool History of a Hot Commodity. You can join in at 800-642-1234. We're big, it turns out, on ice here in the United States. I know I am. Have you traveled to someplace where ice wasn't really a thing? What was that like for you? Or Are you from outside of the United States? Are you wondering, what's our deal with all the ice? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. Amy, the creation of artificial ice, you know, not collected from nature, it changed our beverages, our food, a lot of other things. And another, you spent a chapter or two on sports, and this really shook things up, especially in the ways that women could be out doing sports in public. Can you talk about, you know, artificial ice surfaces and how they change things?
Absolutely. So ice skating was really popular in the early 19th century, even before we had indoor skating rinks. And one of the reasons why they were so popular was because young couples could enjoy ice skating outdoors together, spending time together, without being under the watchful eye of a guardian. ice skating really was seen as the domain of young people, lest an older person fall and hurt themselves, or so went the thinking of the day. And so because it was so popular among young couples, women were encouraged to take part in the activity. And at the time, there were some, but not a lot of physical sports-like activities that women were encouraged to participate in. And so because women were ice skating, they had to consider how their garments affected their ability to stay upright on the slippery ice. And this was an era when women's skirts were very long. And so it was easy to trip on them. So they started hiking up their skirts and ultimately started buying clothing that was just a little bit shorter so that they wouldn't trip over their garments. And so in this way, ice skating led to changing social mores about women showing off their ankles and wearing shorter hemlines.
And then we had sports like curling and hockey that existed in some forms on frozen ponds before that, but the ability to create this surface, and not just when it was cold, how did it change those games?
Well, prior to indoor ice skating, sports like ice hockey and curling, though curling barely existed in the United States before indoor ice rinks. It was really just ice hockey and ice skating. Prior to the invention of indoor skating rinks, these were activities that were only experienced in northern climates where ice formed naturally. But once we had the ability to create indoor skating rinks, we could bring that popular pastime of ice skating that once only took place on, say, the Wisconsin, you know, the Milwaukee River or the Hudson, could suddenly take place in Florida or Arizona. And that radically popularized sports. You know, now there are, ice skating rinks in almost every state in the union. And there aren't a lot of sports where you can say that it's, so popular that there are spaces dedicated to it in every single state.
Your book is bookended with a change in climate. Ice becomes less available at the end of the Little Ice Age. Rivers and lakes aren't freezing as much. And now there's concern. And an irony, you write, we're using a lot of energy to make ice to help us deal with the heat, but that in turn is contributing to climate change. Can you talk about some of those concerns?
Yeah, well, the popularization of ice and the need for cold, the American need for cold, led to the rise of electric refrigeration. And today, there are approximately 110 million electric refrigerators working in the United States alone. And a majority of those refrigerators have automated ice makers, which means that the refrigerator, which is already takes a significant energy draw, draws even more energy because those automated ice makers have motors that never turn off. That's why you can have ice at any time of day or night. Well, all of that energy use is starting to take a toll on the planet. The cooling industry contributes approximately 10% of all carbon emissions, which means it's not the most significant contributor of global warming, but it's not insignificant. And as somebody who absolutely loves ice, I'm never giving up my ice. I love it. But also as somebody who believes in living as gently on the earth as I can, I was curious to learn, are there experts thinking about this problem? And are there any solutions that might be possible in my lifetime? And I was so so excited to learn that there are people who are experimenting with technologies such as certain types of magnets, with a material called plastic crystals, which actually have nothing to do with plastic. It's a word that describes their structure, the molecular structure. They're learning that these materials can actually mimic the type of compression technology that more conventional refrigerators use that draw considerably less energy. And they also don't rely on the same type of traditional refrigerants that contribute to global warming that that conventional refrigerants do. So I'm very excited about this. If we can scale up that technology, that could be a game changer for the cooling industry. And gosh, if there's anything I've learned in writing this book, is that Americans can adapt new types of technology and make widespread transformations in a relatively short amount of time.
Talking to Amy Brady about her new book called Ice. Let's bring on another caller. Laura is with us in Twin Lakes. Laura, hi.
Yeah, hi. Thanks for taking my call. I love the subject. And about in 2019, I took a trip to Alaska. And on one of the excursions, we were served glacial ice in our drinks. And it was just so totally awesome. It was like a blue-white. And it was a great experience, yeah.
Could you tell the difference in the drink, Laura?
You know, it was just, yeah, I think it was partly just in your head. You know, you just realized it was so cold and delicious. I don't know.
Laura, thanks a lot for that call. Amy, that actually that brings me around to something you spent some time in the book, the aesthetics of ice in our drinks. And there are people who argue, I think, about the best shape of ice, the best source of ice to have in our cocktails. What do we know?
Well, the shape, the size, the texture of the ice that you put in your drink can radically change the flavor. Different sizes of ice dilute at different speeds. Some ice is actually just colder than other types of ice. And then there's also the way that ice looks. Ice straight out of a conventional ice machine is a little bit cloudy in the center. And what some bartenders are thinking about is whether a clear ice can make a difference. And what their clientele is telling them is that, yeah, it does make a difference. The drink tastes better. And to my mind, it also just looks better. And so when you go to an upscale cocktail bar in this day and age, don't be surprised if the ice in your cocktail looks extra fancy. And also don't be surprised if that cocktail costs a little more than you're used to, because super clear ice is pretty expensive.
Thanks for that call, Laura. And that takes me back to something early in your book, Amy. Now, the early blocks of ice you mentioned, towed by horses. Now, I've been in marching band back in high school, and I marched in parades behind horses. I know what comes out of the back of horses. This was an issue for our ice quality back in the day, right?
Oh, boy, was it ever. So ice harvesters often employed horses to help cut the ice and then to haul it out of the lakes and rivers and into the back of wagons so that it could be delivered to people's homes. And as you say, you know, horses being the mammals that they are, often let loose their bowels on the ice, the very ice that would soon touch the mouths of thirsty Americans everywhere. And so all ice harvesting crews employed a man who would pull what was called a shine sleigh. And the job of the shine sleigh was to scrape the horse's waste off the ice so that it could be delivered. And it got its name from the oily shine that it would leave behind.
Yum. That's a great place to leave it. Amy, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thanks so much for having me.
That's Amy Brady, executive director of Orion Magazine. We talked to her today about her new book. It's called Ice, From Mixed Drinks to Skating Rinks, A Cool History of a Hot Commodity. You can keep sharing your thoughts on ice. Do you have a favorite ice to put in a particular beverage? Let us know about it. Email ideas@WPR.org. That's ideas@WPR.org. Here's a heavy job going on right now. Literally heavy. The London Zoo just kicked off their annual project of weighing each and every animal in the zoo, big and small. According to their press release, there are over 14,000 animals in the zoo, and the annual weigh-in is part of their required accreditation process. It's a good health check for animals and helps detect pregnancies in some cases. Plus, it gives animal info to share with other zoos and conservation groups. The New York Times reports there's a wide range of weights, from 1,600 plus pounds for a giraffe down to 5 milligrams for a leafcutter ant. How do you get animals to line up on a scale? It takes some trickery. It involves lining them up for feeding time, like for Humboldt penguin chicks on a strategically placed scale. Or sometimes an extra treat is needed, like for Bolivian black-capped squirrel monkeys. That makes me suspicious. Somebody had a bunch of cookies in the break room the other day. Were they just secretly weighing me? This is Central Time.